Today on Against the Grain, the signs of an accelerating climate emergency are everywhere. And while the broad notion of a Green New Deal has caught fire, the details and political hurdles are formidable at best. Radical political economist Robert Pollin joins me to lay out what a just plan should include, why it's imperative, and how it might be financed. He also discusses his concerns about geoengineering and, from the left, the idea of degrowth. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The climate crisis gets worse each year, shifting much of public opinion with it. Yet despite record wildfires and hurricanes, elite inaction continues. In climate crisis and the global Green New Deal, the political economy of saving the planet, which is published by Verso, Robert Pollin and Noam Chomsky make the case for tackling the climate emergency. Robert Pollin is Distinguished University Professor of Economics and co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Bob, it goes without saying that the climate emergency is accelerating, including multiple hurricanes, fires consuming much of the West, among many signs of the extent of the crisis. Can you give us a sense of the magnitude of the problem at this moment?
So if you read the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the most authoritative mainstream climate science consortium, they've made it clear in their October 2018 report that we can no longer work within a framework of stabilizing the climate at 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, that we have to lower the target to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. We are already at roughly 1 degree. And what they're saying is that should we fail to stabilize at 1.5 degrees, what we are going to see is massive increases in intensity in the things that are already happening. I mean, as it is, the predictions that the climate scientists at the IPCC and elsewhere, every year, what they are predicting in terms of intensity of droughts, heat waves, fires like in California, flooding, all of those things that have created such massive disruption, damage, loss of life, et cetera. All of those things are already worse every year than what the models had been predicting. And so that we can only anticipate increasing worsening of the situation, which will happen anyway, certainly over the next decade. If we cross the threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial level as the global average temperature, we're really moving into uncharted territory where we're facing climate disasters. You have these leading authorities like Professor Pierre Hundebert that we cite in our book from Oxford and a leader of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Research, who says he himself says, and you know, this is not the type of person that is going to be hyperbolic. He says, you know, we're facing a catastrophe. Wake up, you know, and there is no plan B other than confronting it aggressively right now. So that's what we're looking at. So what you experienced in California with the fires, what was experienced in Australia with the fires, what was experienced in Puerto Rico with the hurricanes and floods that wiped out effectively 1 year of total economic activity of GDP. That's just a precursor. That's really what we're looking at.
Often we hear discussion of tipping points, of passing thresholds that we can't then go back on or reverse. Have we passed the point of no return?
you know, I'm not the authority, and I just read what people, the researchers in the area of climate scientists say, and of course they don't all agree on everything. So I guess it's fair to say, you know, if I'm following like the mainstream IPCC conclusions, the answer is basically not yet, no. I mean, what the IPCC has said is that we have to stabilize, we have to reduce CO2, carbon dioxide emissions, by roughly 50%, by 45%, as of 2030. You know, that's only 9 years from now. And then we have to be at zero before 2050. And at least according to their mainstream assessment, it doesn't mean they're right, but they think that, you know, we can be on a stabilization path if we accomplish those two relatively immediate goals. Now, even if we accomplish those two goals, a 50% cut in emissions in 10 years, zero in 30 years, we still have to do a lot more because there's other greenhouse gases that we have to deal with. There's the accumulated stock of CO2 that needs to be removed from the atmosphere. But at least if we hit those emission reduction targets, according to the IPCC, we should be able to prevent the crossing of these basic thresholds.
Well, given the caveat, you mentioned that you, of course, not a climate scientist yourself. Do you have any unease or disquiet that these kinds of mainstream projections may be wrong, that they may be too modest? You were talking about zero emissions by 2050, 30 uh-huh. years from now. Others have argued that that would need to happen much sooner. But given how rapidly this crisis has unfolded and how the predictions have often seemed too modest, do you feel like this is something that we can comfortably focus on politically as our target?
Well, not comfortably. I think that it's probably not likely that we can achieve a zero emissions in less than 30 years. I could write it down on paper and tell you that that would be possible. But politically, economically, I don't think it's possible. So I guess my own view is I'm probably assuming that the IPCC's, you know, consensus view that we need to get to zero before 2050 is the target.
How has capitalism driven the climate crisis, and can we sort of separate one from the other?
Well, capital accumulation has certainly been the basis on which we've developed this industrial system that is destroying our climate. So that's exactly why when the IPCC and others say we have to stabilize at what? At, say, 1.5 degrees above what? Above the pre-industrial level. So the pre-industrial level means that at the beginning of industrialization, around 1800, we start to accumulate capital, economic activity, that is very energy intensive. And so what happens starting around 1800 is we start to see the development of industrial development on a foundation of burning coal. It so happens, and we discuss this in the book, at the time there was another power source for the development of the textile industry, which was the first manufacturing industry, and that was water power. And water power, hydropower, was then cheaper, it was easier to use, and it was workable. So then why did the capitalist process switch to coal power? Well, the obvious problem with water power is you needed to have your operations near a water source that could generate the power to operate the equipment. Whereas with coal, you could have the plant, the textile plants, set up anywhere. And that gave capitalists a degree of leverage over workers that they wouldn't otherwise have. If you have to set up the power plant, if you have to set up your industrial plant near a power source, that means you have to attract workers to the power source, as opposed to setting it up anyplace and then you've got workers right there. So the fact that we build an industrial economy on the basis of fossil fuel energy, it was, you know, intricately intertwined with the imperatives of capitalism right from the get-go. And that remains the case. Now, beyond that, of course, we now have a highly developed capitalist global economy that depends on fossil fuel energy above all other sources. About 80-85% of all energy consumption is fossil fuel energy. So it's easy to say capitalist economy depends on fossil fuel energy. However, it's also the case that you can run capitalism on clean energy. You can't run the fossil fuel economy on clean energy, because by definition, we'd have to shut down the fossil fuel economy. But you can still have a variant of capitalism, whether you like it or not. You can have capitalist exploitation with the manufacturing plants, with buildings, with cars, all running on clean energy. And in fact, it would be cheaper than what we spend now on energy using fossil fuels. So capitalism is intertwined, but it isn't strictly that capitalism would, getting rid of capitalism would get rid of the climate crisis. And by the same token, it doesn't also follow that we can't get rid of the climate crisis within a framework of a, you know, dramatically transformed capitalism.
And of course, this is relevant because although a lot of us would wish capitalism away, it seems unlikely that that might happen in the time period that we're dealing with, the really compressed time period that these changes need to take place. But then another question could be posed, which is, okay, whether or not capitalism can exist with renewable energy as its main source of energy, is it possible to resolve the climate crisis under the particular form of capitalism we have right now, which is neoliberal capitalism?
Well, neoliberalism is, you know, a really toxic variant of capitalism. And we're seeing the effects of neoliberalism before us in the U.S. and all over the world. Neoliberalism is a variant of capitalism that is really focused on smashing workers and redistributing income to the rich. And it has been very successful since about 1980 in accomplishing its goals. And that has created the opening for neo-fascism in the U.S. and in many other places in the world. So could you have a climate stabilization path that would operate under neoliberalism? I guess hypothetically, but in fact, certainly would be unlikely, if not totally impossible. Among other things, first of all, yes, we have to shut down the fossil fuel industry. Neoliberalism is organized in such a way to defend the well-being of big corporate capitalists like the fossil fuel industry, like the Koch brothers, to put a name on it, or like ExxonMobil, to put another name on it. So that's one problem with neoliberalism. Another one is, if we're only thinking, let's think about the working class, one of the main requirements, in my view, of transitioning to a clean energy path is that we have to take care of the impacts, the loss of living standards that would otherwise occur for the workers and communities that are now dependent on the fossil fuel sector. So we've got to have a just transition as integral to the overall clean energy project. And under neoliberalism, you won't get it. They may say they're going to get it, but you won't get it, because that's what neoliberalism is about. It's about defending capitalism. It's not about defending workers and their communities. So the project of advancing a clean energy economy, in my view, is part and parcel of overturning neoliberalism.
Robert Polin is my guest. He's a political economist and co-author with Noam Chomsky of Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, the political economy of saving the planet. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So there has been, of course, in the past year, a whole lot of discussion of the idea of a Green New Deal. And yet, of course, the details are varied. For you, what are the essential ingredients of a global Green New Deal?
So, you know, the basic framework is extremely simple. The basic framework is to organize economic activity globally so that we hit the IPCC emission reduction targets, meaning roughly 50% cut in emissions by 2030 and zero by 2050. And how do we do that? There really are two central elements. The one is to massively build up energy efficiency and clean renewable energy. Clean renewable energy means solar, wind, geothermal, small-scale hydro to a lesser degree, maybe some low-emissions bioenergy. But the most critical sources will be solar and wind. And then the energy efficiency investments means that we create buildings that don't waste energy, that we build up public transportation, that we have electric vehicles, and that we use industrial equipment much more efficiently. And the research that I've gone through, and again, I'm not an expert on this either, it's easy to imagine moving towards running the economy at 30, 40, 50% higher levels of efficiency. So if you do that, then the amount of solar and wind that you need to build up over the next decade is a lot lower than it has to be now. So those are the two features, in addition to, of course, cutting the fossil fuel industry at, let's say, roughly about 5% per year, every year, and you can't skip a year. And so once you have that framework, then let's talk about the other features, meaning that this is going to be a major source of job creation. It's a major source of job creation because you're investing. You're investing in building the green economy. Investments create jobs. And a lot of the work I've done shows how these investments in building up the green economy will create, 2 to 3 times more jobs than the number of jobs we have now operating our existing fossil fuel economy. So that's critical, and the jobs need to be good jobs. Right now, if we look at in the U.S. and other countries, which I've looked at, the average conditions for a worker in the clean energy economy are not as good as in the fossil fuel industry. For example, in the U.S., the average pay for somebody in the clean energy sector, say solar and wind, is going to be $70,000-$75,000, whereas the average pay is $100,000 in coal, oil, and gas.
And is that partially because some of those jobs are union jobs in the fossil fuel sector?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was just going to say. So, of course, we never thought about coal for generations. You don't think about being a coal miner as a good job. You think about it as a very difficult, dangerous, exploitative, unhealthy job. But you also have generations of people who have organized in the industry to make them safer and to improve the pay. So what we need is to have unionization develop in the clean energy economy in the same way that it developed historically, or even better, in the fossil fuel economy. And that's not just true in the United States. That's true in many, many other countries. I've done research, for example, in Spain. I've done work in Greece. I've done work looking at this in Brazil and so forth. And, it's the same pattern. India, same pattern. So this is the kind of thing that we need. And so when I think about the term Green New Deal, of course, it invokes the New Deal of the 1930s and the idea of an egalitarian growth project within capitalism, but stretching the standards of equality and social justice, as far as you can within a capitalist framework while still pushing for something more just, a more egalitarian society. So, and the green part is obviously the part about saving the planet. And so that's really what I mean by a Green New Deal. Now, I know that other people have other, detailed proposals within the Green New Deal. People are going to have different definitions, and that's fine. But I think those are the basic features. And I think all proponents of the Green New Deal are probably going to agree with those basics.
What's been the role of industrial agriculture in the climate crisis, and how would you see agriculture in a Green New Deal?
Thank you. Great question. So when we talk about the sources of emissions, carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, methane, nitric oxide are the two other main ones. About 75 on a global basis, about 70-75% of the problem is carbon dioxide emissions, and the other 30% are the other greenhouse gases. Now, burning fossil fuels is about 70-75% of the overall problem as well. So that's 75%. That's a lot, but it's not 100%. So the other major sources of the toxic buildup of greenhouse gases is what we've done with respect to agriculture and forestry. So agriculture, what we've done in introducing industrial agriculture that is highly intensive in terms of using fossil fuel-based sources in growing plants and so forth. And that's responsible, again, I'm citing now the IPCC, the fossil fuel-based fertilizers, that's like another 12% of all the sources, because you eliminate the capacity of the soil to absorb CO2 emissions, and you're emitting CO2 emissions by using fossil fuel-based energy to create fertilizer. The other one, of course, is deforestation. So forests absorb CO2. Trees absorb CO2. When you chop down trees, you release CO2, and you also lose the capacity from the tree, which has been absorbing CO2. So that covers the other 20-25% of the problem. So that is not trivial. So what we have to do is transition out of industrial agriculture into organic agriculture, through which the soil is much more capable of absorbing CO2, and we have to stop destroying the forest, which will then enable us to continue to absorb CO2 at a much better rate. So that when we say, we can say, okay, we've got to get to zero emissions by 2030, if we are also investing in organic agriculture and defending the forests, we will have these natural sources of so-called carbon capture. Low tech, but we know they work to absorb CO2, and that is the part that we need to connect with the investments in building a green energy system.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'm speaking with the co-author of Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, The Political Economy of Saving the Planet. It's published by Verso. The two authors are Noam Chomsky and political economist Robert Polin. He is Distinguished University Professor of Economics and co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. So in thinking about the Green New Deal, how would you imagine that such an undertaking, which obviously means restructuring so much of the economies of the advanced industrialized countries, how would such a thing be financed?
It's actually easy to think about the financing, certainly in terms of the technical parts and the economic parts. The real problem is the political parts. According to my own estimates, and other economists have done similar exercises and come up with fairly similar results, I estimate that the part that I was talking about, when we talk about investing in building up renewable energy, high efficiency, organic agriculture, defending the forest, just transition for fossil fuel workers and communities, add all that up, you're looking at between 2.5 to 3% of GDP per year in all countries. It varies somewhat by country, but that is a fairly standard result that I've gotten, and other people have gotten fairly similar results. So that is, you know, a huge number, and it's not a huge number. If we're talking about the U.S., it amounts to an average of about $600 billion per year over the next 30 years, which ends up being $18 trillion over 30 years, $18 trillion total. So that sounds like an absolutely gigantic number, but it is actually only about 2.5% of GDP, which says, you know, 97.5% of GDP can be used for other things like education or healthcare or other things that we want to work on. Okay, so now where do we get the money? It's still a lot of money, and where do we get it? Okay, the first the principle here is that, look, we do have to come up with the investment funds. We have to come up with the money. But that's true for any investment whatsoever. Any investment, the reason people borrow money is they don't have all the money up front, but they expect to make it back over time with the investment and pay back their upfront expenditures. And that's exactly true here. We know right now that operating a green economy, a green energy infrastructure, is actually cheaper. Forgetting about whether you care about saving the planet, it's cheaper than operating our existing fossil fuel economy. And why is that? Well, first of all, if you invest in energy efficiency, by definition, it means I can heat my home for less money. I can keep the lights on for less money. It means if we have a decent public transportation system, people will spend less money getting to work or going to where they want to go. They won't be stuck in traffic for hours at a time, and it'll be cheaper. Okay, so that's number one. And then number two, the evidence that we have at present is that renewable energy, generating a unit of energy, a kilowatt of electricity, for example, from solar energy or wind energy, is already equal to or less than that from fossil fuel energy and, for that matter, nuclear. I know that because the International Renewable Energy Agency, which is part of the UN, it puts out these statistics every year, and they have been showing this for a couple of years. The most dramatic change has been with solar. Solar power has come down 70 to 80% in just the last decade. Amazing. Now, the other way I know that is, you know, you get the same result if you look at the studies and publications of the U.S. Energy Department today. The U.S. Energy Department today, the Donald Trump Energy Department today, shows you the same thing. This is the same Energy Department in which Trump has banned the use of the term climate change in any memo. But nevertheless, whoever they are, they're putting out these studies. I may be the only one that reads them, but they're putting out these studies that show that solar and wind power are cheaper than fossil fuel and nuclear. So we have to get over that transition. So we need the funds to come up with the upfront capital expenditures. Once we do that, we're going to save money on energy, and we're going to create a lot of jobs. Okay, so how do we come up with that initial capital expenditure? There's various ways, and in our book, we talk about four ways, and in other stuff, other of my work, I talk similarly. I mean, first of all, we can certainly think about cutting back military spending. The U.S. is spending $750 billion right now on military spending, and what I'm talking about is $600 billion total. So getting rid of even a share of the military budget will get us a long way. Secondly, we can also talk about getting rid of all fossil fuel subsidies. Fossil fuel subsidies are huge throughout the world. The problem with the fossil fuel subsidies is that a lot of it is effectively a way to provide subsidies for low-income people that can't afford energy at market prices. So if we're going to get rid of fossil fuel subsidies, fine, get rid of them, but now put the money into subsidizing solar power, or put the money into wind power and efficiency that will lower costs for people and will get us off of our fossil fuel dependent system. We can also talk about, I'm not against a carbon tax, which will discourage fossil fuel investment and raise money. The problem there is the carbon tax, if introduced just flat, will be disproportionately a burden on lower income people that spend more money on energy. So if you're going to do a carbon tax, you have to give back most of the money to the working class and the poor. And the way we discuss it in the book is we say everybody in the world is going to get $60 out of this carbon tax, which isn't that much for somebody in the United States. But if you're in sub-Saharan Africa, $60 is 5 or 6% of income. So that would be three. And then the fourth big one is, why can't we just have a green bond fund financed by the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank? At the drop of a hat, the U.S. Fed has bailed out Wall Street again. They did it 10 years ago, and they're doing it now. To the tune, we don't know exactly, $5-6 trillion, again, pretty much at the drop of a hat. And that's why the stock market hasn't collapsed, even though we're in this desperate economic situation. So if we're talking about $5-6 trillion at the drop of a hat, certainly we can talk about a green bond fund at the level of $100 to $200 billion per year. So like I said, it's not really that difficult to think about how to finance this project.
Tell us about the European Green Deal and what you make of it.
Yeah, if you read their website, it sounds really promising in terms of what they set as their goals, the level of commitment, you know, the rhetoric, and corresponding with that, I mentioned the European Central Bank. The new president of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, who came in December of 2019, when she came in, she gave interviews saying, look, my primary focus as the head of the European Central Bank is climate change. Now, since when does a head of the central bank talk about climate change? Well, she said, no, that's the case. And I have to do it because otherwise I can't look my children and grandchildren in the eye. So they have a really supportive framework in place. However, if you read, you know, the fine print, actually how much money are they committing to the European Green Deal? It's actually a paltry sum. It's maybe, you know, 0.5% of GDP. I'm saying, you know, we don't have to get massively in terms of relative to GDP, but we have to get to 2.5%. You can't settle with 0.5%. We need to get five times that, 2.5% of GDP. So they're talking about $100 billion per year, or 100 billion euros per year, or a trillion over 10 years, when it has to be about five times that. So that's my problem with the European Green Deal. I like what they say and what they say they want to accomplish. And they do talk about just transition for workers and creating a lot of jobs. They say a lot of good things, but they haven't committed financially at the magnitude that is needed.
And why do you think that is? I mean, it obviously goes to this bigger question about why elites have sat on their hands as this crisis has accelerated and accelerated. Why do you think that even an ambitious project like that, that sounds good, just lacks the financial support?
You know, I think that we've got a lot of work to do to push policymakers to embrace things beyond rhetoric. You know, fine rhetoric, it's not a bad place to start. But you have to be able to commit at the level that is going to accomplish the task. And, you know, they just aren't willing to do it. They don't want to talk about taxes. You saw what happened, you know, what, 6-7 months ago in France when they tried to impose the carbon tax.
This is with the Yellow Vests.
The Yellow Vest movement created the Yellow Vest opposition. And why? Well, you know, the way it was done. The way it was done was, yes, we want a carbon tax because that's what we need to save the planet. But it was a carbon tax without any redistribution whatsoever. So, of course, it was a massive imposition on the life of the working class. And then it comes out that, well, working class people are selfish. They don't want to save the planet. Well, you know, what came out of the yellow vest protests is, well, it's all fine and good. We want to save the planet, but we also want to have food on the table every week. Now, we have to break through that. So you can't have these really hatchet job policies that discredit our project, the project of saving the planet. If you're going to have a carbon tax, you have to do it in a way that does not create these massive impositions on living standards of working class people and the poor. That should be so obvious. But because we haven't gotten over that hump, it becomes very difficult to think about how you're going to raise the money. I mean, look at, you know, if Christine Lagarde is serious as the head of the European Central Bank, it would be very easy for her to say, we're going to buy green bonds. We want every single government in Europe to start issuing these bonds. And we, the central bank, we're going to buy them at 0% interest rate and you pay it back over 500 years, meaning basically it's free money. And they could do that. The Fed could do it. The Fed is doing it right now to bail out Wall Street. So they can easily do the equivalent if they say to every single state, every single municipality in the United States, start issuing green bonds and we'll buy them. And that will enable us to invest in the clean energy economy at the level that is necessary. All of these things are easy to do in terms of the, you know, the technical, the economic. It's really a matter of political will.
I'm speaking with Robert Polin. He is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where he's co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute. He's also co-author with Noam Chomsky of Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, The Political Economy of Saving the Planet. That's published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, around this question of what it might take to mobilize people, while we've seen mounting protests about the climate crisis, especially before COVID took over, the inaction of elites, as you're noting, has continued, and the Democratic Party recently took cutting subsidies to the fossil fuel industry off its platform. What kind of political mobilization do you think is necessary to force change, and particularly, whom should it target?
So, it's interesting what's happened with the Democratic position, the Democratic Party position on the Green New Deal and whatever we want. We can use a different name if you want. Clearly the energy around this has come out of young people, the Sunrise Movement, the Planet Extinction Movement, the protests of a year ago, and those have captured the imagination. They've also started to make important connections with the labor movement. I myself am engaged right now in several projects which have brought together environmentalists and the labor movement around designing effective, just Green New Deal programs. So that is all happening. And that's right front and center of, you know, what the Democratic Party should be about and is about in terms of number of people and energy. On the other hand, as you said, so then you have the elites and they could try to water it down. And if you actually just look at the website of the official website of the Democratic Party, they've taken down the proposals that they had put up, I guess, last June. They no longer are there. If you actually go and type in on Google, Democratic Party platform on Green New Deal, you'll come up with a blank page or something. It'll be some notice. I forget exactly what it says. Okay, so then we had Biden at the debate when he said, no, I'm not for the Green New Deal. I'm for the Biden plan. So you look at the Biden plan, which I've done. And there are some good features. There are two good features in particular. One is that he is talking about financing at the level, more or less, level that I think is necessary. which is a major step forward relative to what I said was going on in Europe. Secondly, he does talk about jobs, creating good jobs, using it as a way to promote unions. So that's the other good thing. And he talks about a just transition. Now, the less good part, he actually almost does almost no discussion about solar power, wind power. There's much more focus on carbon capture technology and nuclear power. So carbon capture is the technology whereby, at least in principle, you keep burning fossil fuels, but you have these methods in order to literally capture the carbon and then bury it underground for all time. And that is the way through which you can, the fossil fuel industry can be salvaged. And that's why they like carbon capture technology. Now, carbon capture technology has never been proven on a commercial scale. And let's say it would work in 35 or 40 years. Well, we don't have 35 or 40 years to wait. Solar power, wind power, efficiency are, at this point, they're low technologies. They work. We know they work, and they're cheap. So why isn't Biden for them? Well, because obviously he doesn't want to alienate the fossil fuel industry. And that happened, you know, you saw the vice presidential debate when Pence was pushing Kamala Harris about fracking, you know, fracking as a way to extract natural gas. And a particularly toxic way, by the way, cheaper, but very toxic. And Kamala Harris kept insisting, no, we don't want to get rid of fracking. We like fracking. And so what we have to do, that people that really are committed to saving the planet, is to really keep organizing around a clean energy program that actually can work, that's egalitarian, that is not going to do more harm, that is not going to create more sources of toxicity in the planet and the environment. That means no fracking. We can't have fracking. But the corporate Democrats want to hang on to it, at least for now.
Would it be fair to say then that mass protests, including targeting the Democratic Party, are in order to force them to, presumably, if Biden wins the election, to be able to adopt these policies which run very strongly counter to the ethos of the Democratic Party?
Yes, I would say very strongly against the ethos of the corporate Democratic Party. But as you know, there's Bernie Sanders, and to maybe a lesser extent, Elizabeth Warren represented another wing of the Democratic Party. And that's where the energy in the Democratic Party has come from. If you watch the debate, certainly Pence was on the case with Kamala Harris saying, wait, you said you were for the Green New Deal. You endorsed it. You were against fracking. Now you're for fracking. Well, I think Pence is probably right. And I think what happens with somebody like Kamala Harris, who tries to position herself in the center, to move forward and distinguish herself within the Democratic primary, she had to be sympathetic to getting rid of fossil fuels and the Green New Deal. And now that she's in the general election, she has to move right. And so what we have to do, let's say we get rid of Trump in the White House and we have Biden and Harris, then we have to push them and we have to insist that, you know, if you're going to fight for climate stabilization, it has to be based on things that we know that can work. They can work now, and we have to shut down the fossil fuel industry. And you know what? Shutting down the fossil fuel industry, we can do it. We can create a just transition for the workers and communities. And as for the investors that own the fossil fuel assets, they should have figured out some time ago that it was time to get out. There's a lot of other ways that you can invest your money. And that's what Wall Street is for, allowing you to sell your stocks in one thing and buy something else. That's what they need to do.
I want to end with a question that might presume all sorts of other possibilities for the future, and that is around the desirability of exponential economic growth. Proponents of degrowth, with whom you take issue, argue that we need to transition to a steady state economy in which economic growth is the target and which contracts. Can you tell us why, although you're sympathetic to the proponents of degrowth, why you don't think that this is feasible in terms of programs for the left?
Right. So I've been in debates with the degrowth proponents for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years now. Like, you, thank you for mentioning. I do share the goals of degrowth proponents, but I don't think it's a viable program. At the most general level, what does actually degrowth mean? It's not clear. I mean, if we want to build a viable clean energy economy with zero emissions, some things have to grow massively. The clean energy economy has to grow massively. You know, right now, solar power accounts for maybe 0.5% of all energy resource, of all energy supply in the United States and globally. So we have to get that from 0.5% to, you know, 50, 60, 70%. It's going to be one of the biggest build outs in the history of all industry in the United States and elsewhere. So degrowth doesn't mean anything to me in that. Yes, when I say degrowth the fossil fuel industry, yeah, degrow it to zero. So I think it's important to be more specific. That's my first point. Secondly, if we're going to say degrowth is a solution to climate change in and of itself, well, just do the arithmetic, like fourth grade arithmetic. You know, right now the world generates about 33 billion tons of CO2 emissions every year. And we need to get that to zero. If we degrow, if we reduce economic activity by, say, 10%, which is a massive depression, right now economic activity is contracted by maybe 3.5%. We're talking about a contraction of 3 times the size. If we contract by 10%, you know, you can do the math very easily and don't do anything else with our energy system, we would reduce emissions by exactly 10%. So we would have 33 billion in emissions before we did degrowth, and we would have exactly 30 billion emissions after degrowth within the depression. So it's not a solution in and of itself. It's true that, you know, especially high income people in all in rich countries and everywhere certainly can consume less. And a lot of the level of consumption is grotesque. I totally agree with that. Do I agree that GDP is a bad measure of well-being? Of course I agree with that. I've never disputed that for a second. But that does not mean that just thinking about contracting economic activity as a broad generalization is a solution to climate change. It's not. And so I think it's important for people that are really focused on saving the planet to think about being specific. Being specific means we get to zero emissions. And the way to get to zero emissions is massively grow the clean energy economy very massively, very quickly.
Are you at all concerned that as elites sit on their hands and don't act, as the climate crisis mounts, that the plan B in their back pockets is to do some version of geoengineering, these untested solutions of a sort to, for example, spray chemicals up into the atmosphere to block the sun? Do you think that is a real danger if we are not paying attention that elites may use that as their way of trying to handle climate change?
Well, we know that's what, you know, that's kind of in the back of their minds. We know that. And that's why, you know, I cited at the beginning of our conversation, Professor Pierre Humbert at Oxford, when he says there is no plan B. And what he's referring to is exactly these geoengineering schemes. That are the so-called plan B, as you put it, that, okay, we don't do anything for 25 years, and then we start spraying aerosols into the atmosphere that deflects the sun and cools the global temperature, because that's what happens with volcanoes. And so what we would do is we would, you know, we would kind of replicate, copy what happens with volcanoes on a global scale. clever idea. There's no evidence whatsoever that it works. We have no idea as to what it would do in terms of feedback effects, negative feedback effects, when you are fiddling with the entire global climate in that way. You know, if you look at the research on the geoengineering schemes, they're far, far from being anything that we can rely on. So, yes, I am very concerned. And, you know, I would say the same thing about carbon capture. The carbon capture that we know works is the simple stuff that we talked about. Organic agriculture and using the soil to absorb CO2, and reforestation to use trees to absorb CO2. They work. It's low tech. It's safe. It's better all around. These other things, there's no evidence that they work. And we are in a situation where we have to solve the crisis now.
Bob Polin, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Robert Polin is Distinguished University Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's co-director there of the Political Economy Research Institute. He's the author of many books, including Back to Full Employment and Greening the Global Economy. And he's the co-author, most recently with Noam Chomsky, of Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, The Political Economy of Saving the Planet. That's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.